This episode is brought to you by Fat Expats. It's the new expat magazine that's coming your way next month. If you'd like to find out more about it, head over to twofatexpats.com. You'll see a pop-up and you can sign up and we'll shoot you some information. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kirsty Rice. Still fever-free. And how about you?
Yes, still fever-free.
What I want to know, Kirsty, is are you and your family on the app, the big new app that's been released in Australia this week?
Yes. So you mean the app that the government has released so that they can track people with corona and so that they can identify clusters, right, and see, they'll be able to see immediately if you've been near anyone, et cetera. My children are on the app. I am not on the app as yet, and that is just total fatigue on my behalf. But I think it's interesting that my children were very quick to put themselves on the app and very quick to comply. Didn't care at all.
I didn't question it once.
Not once, because we all know that that generation know that everybody knows where they are, what they're doing, everything. I mean, they're all on TikTok. They've told everyone everything already. And they know that if they haven't, their parents have.
It's quite interesting because as an Australian overseas, I have been fascinated by the conversations around will you get the app, will you not, and the fact that people are, do we trust the government with this data? And I've seen many, many explanations of what data is gathered and when it's released and bits and bobs. And it's sort of, it's a discussion that's been going on in Germany in terms of a way to track it further down, you know, the contact tracing situation. But in Germany, it's highly frowned upon because of a history of tracking and tracing certain groups of people. So it's very, Germany would like to do it because they would like to consider themselves the most advanced in tracking and tracing in Europe, but they morally almost can't. The discussion's been around moral terms in terms of the history that they have is quite poor. It's a long time ago, granted, but so I'm fascinated by it. And also the fact that South Korea have been able to control things quite well by not having an app, but having a similar situation in the tracking and tracing. So I've been very interested in the app. So interested to know that your family are into it.
Would you, if Germany wanted you to download the app, would you download the app?
Yes, I'd download the app. I don't have a problem with it. I'd be on board. Yeah. I mean, we are now, as we've talked about this week, we're now a super high-risk household. So the more information that I can get or I can provide other people about what's going on, then I'm more than happy to do that.
Yeah, and they have gone to great extents, the government, to promise, I guess, and declare that this is information that won't go outside of that particular department, that they won't be sharing it with anyone from, you know, the tax office or the police or the, you know, or the whatever they want, that, you know, you won't be able to track other Australians, so to speak, you know, that it really, I mean, from what I've heard, it's a very boring app to open and get inside. A lot of people thought they'd open it and be able to see all the people around them, you know, that had been exposed or not exposed, and it's really not that at all. It's all Bluetooth operated, right, that sort of shows where you are. But, yeah, I have no fear about the app. I mean, there are so many other things on my phone that I know that I don't have control of, that I've either forgotten about or allowed location services that I shouldn't have. And I mean, I'm one of those people that's either bike riding or walking or whatever and using Strava and all those things as well. I mean, everybody knows where I am at every second, it seems.
So why not tell the state government in case?
Exactly. And I think, Nikki Moffat, we are at 5 days of no cases now.
That's amazing. That's so exciting. It is exciting. I mean, Australia and New Zealand are being held up as massive leaders in the situation. And I think it's fantastic, particularly given the cruise ship situation in Australia, that Australia has been able to get on top of it so quickly and being able to really get a great result. So it's just a couple of states that are having new community transmission cases each day, which is great.
Yeah. We do have an unfair advantage though. We have a lot of space and a lot of room. We don't tend to live high density, and it's been one of the things I think that our cities, we tend to just spread out further, further and further rather than go up. But I guess in a case like this, it's been fortuitous for Australia. We've also done as we've been told as well. I think the government, while I didn't think they were quick at the time, once they did make a decision, everyone pretty much did as they were told in my neck of the woods. I don't know about the Sydney siders at the beach.
Because it's time for today's four fat expat questions. Let's get started. Kirsty, what do we know about the tax implications for expats who've been sent home and will possibly end up overstaying days allowed before breaking the tax rules?
Okay, so this is really something I hadn't thought about until I saw it on our Two Fat Expats Facebook page, and then I thought, Kirsty, that's really something you should be thinking about, seeing you are in Australia at the moment with your non-resident husband. So I did make a few calls about this, and I've done a bit of research. So obviously we've got something like 100 and whatever countries represented in our Two Fat Expats Facebook group. So I can't answer for every country, but what I'd love to do is just answer for a few. So here's the issue in a nutshell. So say, like us, you're Australians that live in Doha. So my husband is a non-resident for tax purposes in Australia. But, of course, he's going to be in Australia now for the next 6 months. So the situation is the Australian government have recognised that they have asked Australians to return home and suggested that Australians have returned home and that these are unique times. And so they have said that they will not be looking at expats, you know, and counting the days and classing them as residents. Where my husband's situation is even completely different is because he's on sick leave. It is taken as leave that's paid from a different country. So it's not Australian. So it's not money earned in Australia while he's here. So he is also exempt. So if you have come home and you are starting to think, holy moly, I'm sure I'm starting to look more resident than non-resident, don't panic. I believe that if you speak to your accountant, you will definitely be exempt in a situation like this. There's a couple of good articles that I can send you to. One's from KPMG, and there's also an article in the Australian Fin Review. I'll put links to both of them for the Australians. If you're in the UK, you can also look at Grant Thornton, and they look at the expatriate tax implications from COVID. A really interesting one from the US is, I was reading about it today, saying that the IRS have just decided to adjust the requirements that qualify you for foreign earned income exclusion. And they're going to give you until July 2020 that you can still stay in the US and not be classed as, you know, being in trouble and not getting that exclusion. And they also said that that's possibly going to be extended. So don't panic if you get to July and you're like, oh, my God, I've got to get out of here. So that can be extended, which it could be. I think in the UK too, they said that they'd look on it on a case-by-case basis. But I really think, Nikki, that sort of under this sort of circumstance, they're just going to have to put a blanket over the whole lot, aren't they? Because there's just too
many. I mean, it's a lot. When you think about it, governments have had to do so much just to deal with the health ramifications and then do economic planning for all the impacts it's had on the economy and the businesses. To have to then write new regulations about all the tax laws and giving, like, governments, they've got a lot going on, governments. But also when you're getting on a plane to go to another country, not knowing when you're going to come back, the last thing you're thinking about is, oh, is this going to impact my tax liability in the next year? I mean, one thing you might think about is, am I going to be covered for health insurance? Like, if I'm going to stay in a country now that I wouldn't normally live in. But apart from that, I just think it's really a lot, but it is a very valid issue. And the longer this situation goes on, the more that these kinds of issues will arise, and governments will make case-by-case decisions, I imagine, based on what comes up at the time. Yeah, it's a lot though.
Okay. So, Nikki, my question to you. I talk a lot about having to plan a lot, and I've always needed to sort of have an idea of where the kids had finished school or where we'd have our forever house or where I'd like to travel by when and how. And I'm wondering, do you think this is an expat thing because of my sort of ever-changing landscape? E.g., if I'd never moved, would I have been so focused on how it was all going to look?
Yes, probably you would have. I think there are people that are and people that aren't. And I think that there are people that change that over the course of their life. And given that if you were never an expat, I just compare that to someone I know in my personal life who's not an expat, but who is an absolute preparer, extensive preparer. I'm talking like 1 to 2 years timeframes for everything, on holidays and immediate travel, and then the 5-year horizon and the 10-year plan and the everything. So I think that that's the kind of person that she is, and that's the kind of person that she would always be. I don't know if she could be an expat in that situation because that might be too much planning for her.
Yeah. See, I don't think I was like that. I think expat life has made me like that.
Yeah. See, that's really interesting. I think I was much more. I have decided now, having this reflective time where I've talked before on the podcast about how I've just kind of let go because I don't think I need to worry about when this particular time is going to end, etc., that I've decided that I used to be much more into planning and and boxes, and now I'm much less into it, and I don't know why that is. But I, over time, and I think it's had to do with my mental state, I think I went through a period of depression, and before that I was a much better planner and much more focusing, and then after that I've been less so. And that's a really recent revelation regarding my mental health, and I don't think I'm less healthy mentally because of it, but I can acknowledge that before I went through that period I was much more focused and planning and everything, and then since that period I've been less so.
Right. So yeah, you kind of had to let go of it and just have to roll.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's what happened. Like, I've realized that it is a transitional thing. It was like a transitional country for me because it's when I went through my depression. And I think I can see myself before and after as different. I'm the same person, but a different kind of planning boxes, that kind of thing. I'm more go with the flow. I don't know everyone would say that about me, but I would say it about myself.
Yeah. See, I wondered whether I tried to grab things to get a bit of control over. And I wondered whether that was because I'd always been aware that my partner's job was the reason we moved. It wasn't my job that was making us move. Mm. It was his job that was making us move. And, you know, I always go back to, I remember having a friend in KL who was very good at getting her life organized in each location, like finding herself work and getting everything organized and having a big friendship group and just, you know, rolling with it. But her saying that it drove her nuts that she knew that her partner's job could just ruin that in an instant. Do you know, like, she was an aerobics instructor and a hairdresser, and so she'd set up her clients and get her gig at the local gym and do all of those things, and everyone thought she was fantastic, and she'd have packed classes and a busy schedule, but she always knew that one day her partner was going to come home and go, oh, by the way, we're going to XYZ, and it would all be over. And I was thinking about it, Nikki, because there was a really great question in the group yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, about a woman. Oh, well, of course you saw it. You posted it because it was an anonymous question.
It was anonymous.
So the anonymous question was one where A woman was asking about staying in one location where her husband had a very niche career that he could really only have where he was. There weren't the same opportunities at home. And she'd given it 5 years where they'd had two children and they'd been there. And now her son had been offered schooling at a school that she was very keen for him to go to. It was out of their catchment area, so she knew that it was an opportunity, you know, that could be maybe a once off. And she was asking the group, you know, do you think I should take my children home and my husband stays here and I go home and then my children can get into this great school? And they were still little. And she was saying, and my mother's there and, you know, I'll be able to start working again, etc. And I took that question to our dinner table last night to my kids because I was really interested to hear what my children would say. And they had such a black and white, you know, opinion, as we've talked about before. Our teenagers tend to have
the gray space.
There is no gray space. And my youngest child, well, first of all, the kids always said, oh, but, you know, how old are her children? And I think she said they're about 5 and 3. And
they're about to start primary, yes, I guess.
Yeah. And the kids were like, but why would you do that when your children are so young? Like, they don't care. Why would you want to take them back to that school when they're so young? Why would you split up the family when they were so young? Then I sort of said to them, oh, yeah, but, you know, what about her career? Do you know, like, she's saying she wants to go back and sort of focus on her career. My youngest was like, oh, well, only if she's going to earn more than her husband. And I thought, right. And I said, but what if she never, you know, if she continues to stay away, if she can't get back to that work? And, you know, I also thought it was interesting in the question, there was no sort of mention about what her husband thought of all of this, like what.
Oh, there are plenty of people to point that out.
But I guess because everybody wanted to know, well, what was his view. But what I liked about it for my personal conversation with the kids was we put ourselves in the same position and we went back to when mum and dad had first gone away and what mum's career looked like after 5 years and three children and, you know, four countries or however, and where I was at and what that meant to me. And it's a really great exercise, I think, to do as a family. So your kids can think about what you used to look like and what your family was in the past and how it's affected, how that travel has affected both of your careers and what you've given for each other.
So basically you smoothed over the answers until you got what you wanted to hear, no? Kidding. You developed them into it. You corralled them into an area? No. So what was the final outcome? No, I know you didn't do that. I'm kidding. What was the final outcome?
No, it was good to get the input from Dad, like what G was saying. Because when we went back to the 5 years, it was, you know, that Dad had this fabulous job in Canada that he really, really enjoyed. And it was interesting because my husband said, oh, yeah, but, you know, we decided that that was a great job for me. And, you know, that was going to give me a stepping stone into, you know, the next job and whatever, which of course is absolutely right, but it wasn't helping my career at all. What I think my husband got very lucky was that I then managed to get a job in Canada and went back to work and was very happy at work. And we had, you know, we'd had all of our four children, and because I had four kids in 6 years, I guess probably pre me going back to work and being 5 years out of the workforce. No, I was that woman. Do you know, I guess looking, going, well, what does this mean for me? And how much longer am I going to be out of work? And should I be doing this? Because we were living a very suburban life in Canada. And there were many times where I thought, well, I'm living a very suburban life here in Canada. I could be doing this in Australia where it would be a lot easier and a lot more comfortable because I'd be surrounded by family and friends and, you know, not having to do this gig. So it was, I think it was good for us as an exercise to go, okay, well, where were we and what did our life look like, and have a really honest conversation as a family about it. I don't know, what did you think of the question, Nikki? Because, I mean, the thing is, we can't judge anyone's decision about what they're going to do.
And that's a thing about anonymous questions. I really understand why people want to post them anonymously. We've had this discussion before. And when I saw the question, I thought, I just know what one group of people are going to say. I know what another group of people, like I predetermine the responses. And so that's why I wrote at the top of the post, please make sure you read the entire thing, because there are lots of things to consider. And one of them was the primary school that was out of area. One of them was that she left a business that she could pick up if she went back. One of them was her aging mother. You know, one of them was also her husband, which we didn't seem to be a factor. And that's, I take that on me, because often if someone sends me an anonymous post, I'll go back to them and say, what about this, or have you considered this? And then people will say, oh, thank you, I'll change the post. And so it gets put into the group with a little bit more information, because sometimes someone will send me something and I'll say, the first thing people are going to ask is, what country is this, or you know, how old are your children, or what schooling have they had before? And so I try to help people not rewrite the post, but just put as much information as possible, because otherwise it's really difficult and frustrating for the people that are trying to contribute, and also for the person who's trying to get the opinion, if all people are doing are asking questions and they can't reply because it's anonymous. So,
that's a very good point, Nikki, is that I don't think people realise how much is involved in those anonymous questions too, because quite often you and I read them and go, oh, gosh, you're going to get crucified for this. You really need to reword that. And just because people aren't thinking of, you know, how they look anonymously, they think everybody knows that they're a really nice person deep down, and that they really have the best well-meaning thoughts you can imagine. What would have you done
in that situation? When we left Australia, and I've said this before, we left for 3 years, and we were definitely going to return by the time that our eldest child started school. And, you know, he's in his second last year of high school. So I think my answer would have to be, but I can't answer that from the point of view of, in Hong Kong, which is our first country, I had an amazing job. I had the best job I've ever had, and I loved it. And so in that situation, I would not have gone home. And then I have to look at it from where I was. So I can only relate it to my experience. I've never lived where she lives now, which is in the UAE. But I don't know is the answer, but I don't think so. But I don't know. I don't know. What about you?
Look, one of the things that really stuck out for me for that post was in one of the answers, because it's 2020, and in one of the answers it said,
I saw that.
You should think about joining a group called Repat Wives with Expat Husbands. And I read it and thought, number one, that's a very niche group. But number two, when will we have a day when that is just expats with repat partners? I mean, we've interviewed same-sex couples in this group before, and we've talked about how easy it is to exclude same-sex couples just by wording. Like, just change a couple of words and you've really excluded someone. But also the fact that we are just assuming that it's always going to be, you know, the husband with the job and the wife with the kids and the returning home, you know. And I think,
and in fact, in our group, we even have I know of at least one person who is a parent and a woman and who works in a different country while her partner, who is a man, mm-hmm. is with her children in their home country. And exactly. so I think even within our group, which is a very yeah. small sample of the world's expats,
yeah.
it exists. So yeah. I think, yeah. No, I saw your comment and I applauded it.
Thank you. But I think back to your original question of what would I do, I think if anything I've learned over 20 years of being an expat is that while we are all convinced that our own marriages are unbreakable and rock solid, we will learn in our travels that that might not always be the case for everyone. And so a really good thing to have in your back pocket is, what would I do if I was suddenly forced to, you know, get back to work, or, you know, have to raise my children on my own? We've done episode after episode of divorce and separation or death or whatever. You know, Nikki, you and I are both in a crazy situation right now where your husband could have been dead and mine has had a really severe cancer diagnosis. So we are living, breathing examples of what would happen if the worst thing happened. Do you know, what would we have done? How would we have done it? How would we have managed? So my thing would be, yeah, to talk to your partner about how are you both going to have careers that are successful. Because while that, and also go and read The Wife Drought, because while you're thinking,
best book ever.
While you're thinking, oh, my husband earns more money than me, and so it is the clever thing to do to pin all of our hopes on his career because he earns more money. Just remember how much money you're costing yourself by not working, and that if you both could work, you know, you could even that up as you go along. And whether that's also putting money into your superannuation and your investments or anything along the way. And while not all of us want to go back to the office while we're raising children, just don't stop thinking about what little tweaks you can do to your career so that if you did have to go back, that you could. And I think that that's what's stunning to worry this woman too, is, you know, well, where am I? We're 5 years down the track. I could get my family set up. And because, yeah, none of us go thinking we're going to go for 20 years.
I don't think anyone does, no.
Yeah, yeah. But just work out where do you fill in the gaps? If you're feeling a little bit nervous and you're feeling you want to get, yeah, sure, where do you fill in the gaps? So, yeah, no, I wouldn't have separated us at that stage, because I think, you know, small children are there to be shared, not to be done on your own. You're a brave woman to do it on your own. But I think it is, you have do have lovely, lovely times with small children when they're shared and you can go and have a break. I think it's a big call to do it on your own. But, yeah, be wise to, okay, I've been gone for 5 years. What does this look like for me? How do I do? My kids wanted so much more detail, you know, well, could she do the business, you know, together, and could he, you know, go back and forth or whatever. They were definite about, Mum, you've got to go back and get more detail.
That's funny. Okay, Kirsty, following on a little bit from what we discussed there, given your current situation medically with G and previously when you were dealing with breast cancer, did you consider it time to go home, in inverted commas, just move back? And did people suggest you strongly that that was the best thing to do?
Okay. So when it came to me being diagnosed with breast cancer, people were the kind of more interested about how it was all going to work. Now, I think a big thing in this was I was at home, inverted commas, in Australia when I received my diagnosis. And I think that makes a big difference, because if you're away from home and you have to ring your parents or ring your friends and sisters and brothers and say, hey, this just happened, people probably panic a bit more because you're away. You know, it all seems scarier. Whereas if you're already at home and they can see, touch, feel, understand the medical system, know what's happening, I don't think it's that scary. And it wasn't probably as scary for me because, you know, for instance, I was diagnosed, you know, that morning, and then had to, you know, go and have a couple of extra tests and go back to the doctors and get home. By the time I got home, one of my besties was sitting at my kitchen table, you know, waiting for me. So I was surrounded by things I'd known. So people were more about, where are you going to have the treatment? What's going to happen with the kids? And I started a new job a couple of weeks after I had my surgery and just before I started chemo. So I really kind of tucked myself away at home in Doha. And, you know, because I flew back, I had the surgery, I flew back to Doha. I kind of pushed through chemo and work and kids, and I didn't really see a lot of people. And so that kind of, it came, it went. So no, there was no sort of push. Now, when it comes to G, it's a completely different kettle of fish, right? Because he's been employed in Doha for the past 10 years and he's been with the same company there. He's kind of firmly entrenched in his Doha life and his Doha job. So when he was diagnosed, you go straight into that, well, what does sick leave look like and what does healthcare look like? And we had this really extreme COVID-19 circumstance. You know, it just wasn't normal because everything.
No, no. Your family just doesn't do anything like
So I think if it had been normal, we'd have a lot more to answer for. But because of COVID-19, the particular surgery he needed is actually done by a German doctor in Doha who flies in and out. And so because of COVID, it wasn't going to get done. Do you know, like the hospital we were at, they did one lot of surgery like that a year perhaps, whereas the person from Germany goes to the public
hospital. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he just does it all day, every day for 2 weeks, and then he disappears for 2 weeks, and then he comes back and does it again and disappears. That's how it works for him. He's a specialist in that area. But, of course, that wasn't going to happen. He wasn't flying in and out. So, really, when we came to Australia, it was for G to, you know, see a surgeon, get that advice, and then the world just shut down, do you know, and so he's here. So it's been very different. But I think the root of the question, Nikki, is, you know, do people say, hey, you've had a massive catastrophe in your life, it's time to come home? Do people say that? And I think people think it. I definitely think people wonder, you know, whether it's really time to just come. I think my parents might have suggested it when it came to me, as in a, we don't like this, you being so far away and shit going down. And I think with G, there's that stress when you have this situation of that person is thinking, what happens if I die? You can't help but think, what happens if I die? Because you're faced with that reality. And so when you start thinking, what happens if I die? You start thinking, what happens to my partner? What happens to my kid? What happens to for them money-wise? How? What does my funeral look like? How do they fly me home? Where do I want to get buried? Do you know all these terrible things that, you know, of reality, and they're incredibly stressful. So it just, it's where you're at. And, you know, Nikki, as you know too, when you have that treatment, the drugs they give you, everything on top of that makes you more anxious, more stressful. So I think G and I, this is why COVID-19 was a gift. Do you know? I look at, we're home, we're settled, we're with our kids, we've got all this time to get our ducks in a row, you know, time to heal and relax and plan and whatever. Everything's, we're in this very normal world of me driving him to chemo and whatever. It could have been so much more stressful had he been in Doha. And just to, because I realize I've answered this question way, I've taken so long to answer it, but I guess one of the things that G and I keep going back to is we keep saying, well, when this all ends, when you know, you've had all your treatment and when you're better and when you're okay, we're all going to go back to Doha, like the entire family. We're going to go back to Doha. We're going to be reunited with our poor old dog who's there, you know, while she's very happy and healthy, you know, and being looked after. We are missing her terribly, but we want to go back and we want to jump on a dhow boat with all of our friends in Doha, and we just want to enjoy everything that Doha has to offer, and we feel that that will be the perfect end to what's been, you know, the strangest time of our life. So I don't know. Does that answer it?
It does answer it, because just this week, and we talked about it on the Facebook Live, but we haven't talked about it on the podcast. Last weekend, my husband was hospitalized and had to have an operation, and he's very private about his health. So I can't really say more than that, but it was a very serious incident, and you're right, something bad could have happened. And I've had several people this week contact me and say, okay, that's it, it's time to come home. I'm just saying, for what purpose would it be time to come home? And to their credit, no one in our family has said that, to my knowledge, but it's just such a strange thing to me, because we're incredibly lucky. He was here with us in Germany. He was just preparing to go to Denmark. So that was, you know, that's bonus for us. The German healthcare system is very good by all evidence. And, you know, he was well taken care of. He had a successful operation and now he's home with us and recovering. And I just think, why would it be time to come home? Like what about this situation would make us think it was time to come home? And in fact, I asked him, I said, does it make you think we should go home? And he said, no. So it didn't occur to me. And I don't know whether people have contacted him, but people have certainly contacted me and said, okay, time's up. You need to come back. And I think it's because of what you said, like people can't see you. So they can't see that you're okay, or you know, like they just want to be able to touch you. And meanwhile, if we were in Australia, these people who tell us it's time to come home, we wouldn't see them regularly. We wouldn't see them, you know, daily or weekly or monthly, probably even some of them. So it's just weird to me that people have that reaction. I would never think to say to someone, you think it's time to go home now? Like, you think you've had enough of this? I don't know. Also, because we don't have a home in Australia, like you guys have a home and you have kids there, and like all our life is here. So all our immediate family, we're all here together, and I can't, and the upheaval of moving everyone, and you know, some people don't have a choice and I totally get that. And had any outcomes been different, I don't know what would have happened, but I just found it very strange that people started contacting me saying that to me. That's all. And so I just was interested in your own experiences. So I think thank you for sharing.
Okay, Nikki, I'm borrowing a question from Tor Fours, who I'm pretty sure that's not her real name, but that's what her identity is in our Facebook group. And she said, would you choose to be an expat if frequent travel by air or sea became extremely limited, expensive, and infrequent, e.g. you couldn't travel home or elsewhere? Would you still choose to be an expat, Nikki, if those things were off the table?
Yeah, I don't know. Now, like 17 years in, maybe yes, continue. But at the start, probably not. That's what I'm going with. So if you presented me with it right at the beginning and saying, okay, these things don't happen, like you can't fly home when you want, blah, 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 I would maybe have said no.
Yeah.
But now I'm here, I'm 17 years in, I'm living far away from my family with no way to get to them right now, extended family and friends, I'm thinking I'm okay with it for now. I don't know. That's my sort of initial response. What about you?
I think this question is very focused towards if you were going to a great location or a location that you were a little bit hesitant about. If you said to me,
good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Like if you
Libya.
Yeah. Libya. You're going to Libya, you can't get out, you can't go anywhere else, and you'll just have to wait and see how long we decide to send you there for. I don't know. I think I'd probably be like, oh, no, I need some more definite details. I mean, people did in the past, right? I mean, that's where we've become very spoiled as expats, because people used to do that. That's what they did. They took an assignment and they went there for 3 years and they fulfilled that assignment. And then
on a
they
ship.
Went. Yes, they went by ship. And this is where we're all weak, aren't we, as expats now?
Weak.
We're all princes and princesses with our travel and our demands and what we'll do. Because, yes, I still remember my friend Tim, who's a twin. His mother, you know, was an expat and all these incredibly, you know, harrowing, what I could only describe as harrowing locations, where she went by ship and, you know, survived through malaria and, you know, having to eat donkeys and, you know, to sort of live a very different life.
I draw the line at donkeys. Yes. Okay, if you're putting donkeys in there, I'm out.
So, no, I think I love to travel and I'm not sure how I'd cope about not being able to get home to a sick parent or a sick sibling. But I also think this is the difference between an expat and an immigrant. Whenever people say, you know, why aren't we all called immigrants? Why are some people expats and some people immigrants? It's because those who become immigrants, they face these decisions. They stay because they've said, you know, this is where I've chosen to go and I'm going to stay and I'm going to stick it out and no matter what, and off I go. So, yeah, I think I'm a no. Okay, Nikki, three favorite things.
Okay.
What
three favorite things
are yours? Tell me a couple of yours.
TV-wise, so I talked last week about watching The West Wing again and how lovely it was and relaxing and familiar. Mm-hmm. And I found out this week on Twitter that Richard Schiff, who plays Toby in the series, is hosting on Twitter #WatchWithRichard and watching The West Wing from the start of the series with his Twitter followers. So they count down 3, 2, 1, press play on the episode, everyone presses play, and then they tweet along with it together.
Oh, how cool.
So it's fantastic. A big now, fan, big fan
I
of that.
Did see somewhere, Nikki, I saw him send that out on Twitter and his partner looked very familiar as well. I'm guessing she's an actress.
Now, she is an actress. She looked familiar to me as well, so I Googled her and she is an actress, yes.
Right.
And I worked out the things I've seen her in, yeah.
Okay, what's she been in?
Well, she was in The Good Doctor, which is something I watch now, which coincidentally, so is Richard Schiff. And she was also in a couple of things in the past that I went, oh, yes, that's right. That's familiar to me. I can't off the top of my head, but I did remember.
But I did see he said he was maybe going to write something on Medium as well about, you know, like to go in with the, you know, let's watch it together on Twitter, blah, 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 that he might try and get his act together. Yeah, so something to look out for. Okay, what else?
Oh, the other thing is season 4 of The Good Fight has started and I love The Good Fight and I've talked about it before. But the favourite thing that I had about it this week was at the end of the episode they put together a 2-minute clip of why they can't broadcast the next episode for 2 weeks instead of 1 week. Oh. And they had this world map and they showed where all their producers and music people and editors were all around the world and they showed where they had to send everything. And it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think I talked last week about when is television going to end because the production has run out because they're not producing television. But this is obviously it's been produced, but it just has to be – I mean, it's been filmed, but it has to be produced, which is a many leveled and layered stepping process. So it was kind of cool that they showed us at the end and then all the actors and the crew sang a song together on Zoom. Now, which is very
the woman, The Good Fight is a spin-off of The Good Wife, right?
Correct.
And the woman in The Good Fight is
Christine Baranski. Yes. Christine,
and
yeah.
Have you seen the video this week of her and Meryl Streep and another actor who I'm very bad at?
Yes.
I can't. That we should include the link to that where they sing, here's to the ladies who do whatever it is from a Broadway
yes,
show.
Yes, it's for the 90th birthday of the producer or the writer of that song.
Wow. That's good. Okay, what else? You've got number 3. What's your third favorite thing?
Okay, my third thing is a new podcast that I'm listening to that I am raving about and I'm sending messages to all my people who always ask me for podcast suggestions. It's called Rabbit Hole. It's done by the New York Times. So I first found it on the feed for The Daily because it just appeared because they're putting it in there. And it's fantastic. It's 3 episodes so far. And they're called Start Here, Wonderland, and Looking Down. And it's totally edge of your seat stuff. I mean, the New York Times does a great podcast. I love the Daily. It's really well produced. I like the whole way it does. Mm-hmm. But this is amazing. The storytelling, the whole way it progresses, and it's telling the story between a consumer of content online, so sort of the internet and how he got into the internet, and then at the same time they're telling a story alongside that of the algorithm maker, so a French guy who worked for Google who wrote or worked on the recommendations algorithm. So, you know, when you go to YouTube and you watch something and then down the side it's got all the recommendations of what to watch next. Uh-huh,
yeah.
And so he worked on that algorithm.
Oh.
And when he saw what that algorithm was doing, he worked on something, another kind of algorithm to try and negate what was actually happening. And he ended up getting fired from Google, which he said was totally justified because his main job was to work on the addicting recommendations algorithm and he was spending most of his time on something else. So
Wow.
Anyway, it's an amazing story. And, you know, they're weaving the narrative. But it's one of those podcasts and they don't – you can't do it very well usually, but they do it so well. It's got a sudden stop. So where you have to look at your podcast app to see if it's paused or, like, the episode's finished.
Oh.
Because they're just sort of building to a point and then it just podcast finishes.
Oh.
So it's like, oh. So twice, the two main episodes I've listened to, I've like, oh. No, oh, no, it's finished. So there's no, like, you know, thanks, and that was the rabbit hole and it was produced by blah, blah, blah. It's not. It's just like you get to the point in the story and then nothing.
We're done.
So it, like, leaves you really wanting to know what's next. Oh. I love it. I love it. I love it. Big fan. Haven't been this excited about a podcast for a long time.
Okay.
Okay, Kirsty, what are your favorite
things? Right, so I watched Inside Bill's Brain, which isn't new. It's been on Netflix for a while. It's about Bill Gates and it sort of tells you the story of Bill Gates. I didn't look at who produced this, but I think it's an interesting look at Netflix documentaries. It all seems like you're not going to hear anything bad about Bill. You're only going to hear about good Bill and what Bill did well. You will get a little bit of an insight to where Bill might not be really, really good, but for the main part, Bill's good. So you kind of watching it going, is this produced by Microsoft or is this produced, do you know what I mean?
It's a sponsored production.
But at the same time, it is a worthy watch for his bridge playing with Warren Buffett, his the insights for the people that worked with him in the early days, understanding who Bill's mother was, getting great interviews with Bill's sisters, getting a look at Melinda and understanding what Melinda is and does. And I thought it was really interesting and well worth the watch. I also thought when I'd finished watching it, because you really do see all the great things that the Gates Foundation has done and why they've done what they've done and the science behind it. So it made me think about documentaries now. And is this just a way of, okay, do you make a choice? We could produce something for Netflix where we're going to show all the great things that the Gates Foundation's done and nobody will watch it. Or we're going to produce something where we're going to make people think they're going to get the inside scoop on Bill Gates, but we will surreptitiously throw in what the Gates Foundation has done so at least you can see and understand the story. So I did think it was interesting and well worth a watch, and it was one of my favourite things over the last week. Excuse me, I can hear my children giggling in the background and screaming, so if you can hear that. Just a little side note, last night at 1 a.m. I woke up because I heard this massive scream and then, you know, giggles, and I came out to find out that my second daughter had gone to the bathroom, and while she was in the toilet, she heard my youngest son also go to the toilet. So she thought it would be really clever to go back to his room while he was still in the bathroom and get in his bed. And so when he walked back to the door, he stopped in the doorway, looked in his bed, and she sat up bolt upright. And he screamed his head off. And then they giggled and giggled and giggled and giggled. And I couldn't stop laughing. I had to come down and say, go back to bed. But I do think it was very funny. And it was a little bit of COVID-19 restlessness at 1 a.m. in the morning. The whole house was up to have a laugh at what she'd done. I hope she never changes. I think it's very funny that that's her personality. Okay, so inside Bill's brain. Then G and I have started Game of Thrones, and I'm not sure whether it is one of my favourite things, Nikki. I'm up to episode 5 or 6. I'm persisting. Are you a Game of Thrones person?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I love it. But I didn't love it in the beginning. Right. It's one of those things where I didn't have to push through because I, you know, I consume a lot of mediocre TV, so I'm all for watching things. But as you know, but I did watch the first season. I think if you get to the end of the first season and you want to keep watching, then you'll be hooked. Like, but I think you really have to watch the first season. And, you know, if you start hating it, don't. I mean, it's quite confronting, and there's
a lot of violent
stuff going on. There's a lot of violence. That doesn't really go away, but you kind of become not immune or addicted. They're the wrong words, but you kind of, you know, the violence is part of the story.
Right.
And so you develop feelings about which way it's going to go. But the end of the first season, the ending is so shocking that it really forces you to keep going, in my opinion.
Okay. So I am sort of sitting there going, how many kingdoms are there? Do I need to read something that tells me who's in what kingdom?
No, you don't need it'll to come. You, because it'll come. Okay. It'll
all right,
come.
I will.
It's very complex.
And now the other thing is I think every person on the planet has watched Afterlife season 2 this weekend because it was, in my mind, absolutely the best television I have watched in a long, long time. And I won't bore everyone by talking about it because I'm sure that every podcast and every person is talking about Afterlife season 2 and how good it was. The only thing I will say that I wasn't keen on was the psychiatrist or the psychologist that I thought that was over the top. I think they probably overdid it a bit in that. Have you watched season 2 yet, Nikki?
I haven't. See, Orthodox, you had to sell me Afterlife 2. I didn't ever finish season 1 of Afterlife.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Nikki.
You know, and I'm just not up for anything heavy right now. So I know that it's heavy. So I'm just having a break from heavy right now.
Yeah.
So, but I do acknowledge that I do need to watch it because everybody talks about it in the same way that they talk about Fleabag, in it just being quite a life changing, a very different way to present things and just, you know, not the same. Obviously, they're totally different, but they are a totally different type of television.
Yes.
They're totally different type of production.
I think the general consensus is it's just so real, and there's no beautiful people in either season 1 or season 2 of Afterlife. They're all very normal people. They've all got faults, and they're all very real, and nothing's fabulous. And I think that is Ricky Gervais to a T, isn't it? That's just him. One of the things that does happen in Afterlife 2 that took me back, though, and, you know, I had this conversation with the kids about why I loved Afterlife and that things are so real and whatever, and you can't help but make the distinction between American television and British television when you do this because they're not all beautiful. And then the kids were saying about, oh, yeah, but that's just because you like British stuff and you're anti, you know, American canned laughter and whatever. And then my son needed to tell me that canned laughter was invented in Britain, you know, not in the US, and, you know, because he knows everything, because we all know if you want to know anything, just ask a 16-year-old boy. But one of the things that came out of season 2 of Afterlife was there's a moment on a park bench where two characters talk. They use the fable of the frog and the scorpion. And while she was telling him the fable of the frog and the scorpion, I was thinking, I've heard this. I know I've heard this before, but it wasn't a frog and a scorpion. And it took me back. I remember David Rakoff, who was on This American Life. And, you know, Nikki, I've been a fan of This American Life since, you know, back in 2000 and
early adopter
back from when we lived in Canada and I used to listen live. Yeah. And so David Rakoff was one of my favourite writers, him and David Sedaris. But David Rakoff is amazing because he used to write in verse a lot, and he wrote one entire novel in verse. But he told in one of the, you know, how in This American Life they have the acts, you know, there was like act one, scene five, or scene two, or yes, scene three. One of them was about the tortoise and the scorpion, and it's called Come Pierce My Shell. Anyway, I will put, because there's a reading of David Rakoff reading it, it is one of the best pieces of writing I've ever heard. And the premise of it is Nathan's been asked to give a speech at a wedding, and Nathan happens to be the ex-boyfriend of the bride and the best friend of the groom.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's just written so beautifully and all in verse, and I thoroughly recommend it. I miss David Rakoff. He's one of the first writers that I just cried and cried when he died, because I just thought, oh, we should have had, you know, another 20, 30 years of amazing writing from you. He was just, yeah, that good that the rest of us can only dream of. And my very last quick thing was Anzac Day in Australia. I don't know if you saw, Nikki, what happened in Australia on Anzac Day. Because of COVID-19, it was all cancelled. And, you know, usually we have an Anzac Day march. Anzac Day is for our New Zealand Australian veterans, you know, commemorating not only Gallipoli but all of our diggers and soldiers. But there were no marches, there were no gatherings, there was nothing. And so it absolutely brought out the best in Australia, and I hope that they try and continue it in some way. I think it almost brought young people back to Anzac Day in a silly way, because it just felt like more people commemorated by gathering on the street, or, you know, drawing poppies in their driveways. They say that more people watched it on television at dawn than had ever watched it. So it was really something to see. It was definitely a moment. It was definitely a moment.
So what did they have on TV? So I know that everyone went to the end of their driveways, and I saw your video of your youngest son playing the last post on the flute, which was very moving. Yeah. But I know that on the TV they had a lone bugle person go through the centre of the MCG, which is a big, big sporting arena, and just stand by himself and play the last post. What else did they have on TV to commemorate? Because they can't have had any gatherings, did they? Or how did that work?
Well, they had very small gatherings. So they had at, you know, they've got the unknown.
The War Memorial.
So they had people very spread out, and just a handful. And they had, so at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, they had on each corner, you know, part of the Army, the Navy, et cetera, like to represent, you know, the one soul bugle player, then the one soul anthem singer for New Zealand, the one soul anthem singer for Australia. And so they just had them miles apart and a much smaller gathering. And then in each state, because we listened, because that was the hard bit, right? Because it's all like, okay, we're doing this at dawn. So we get up in the pitch black at 5:47, and I'm saying to Craig, yeah, but the sun rises at like 6:30. Why are we up at 5:47? But it actually isn't so much dawn. It's still very dark when you're doing it, and you're not sure when to do it, because it's not like New Year's Eve where there's a countdown. So we go to the end of the driveway, because they told us as Australians, go to the end of the driveway. Now, we live in a beachside holiday location, right? So most people don't live where we live, that this is all, you know, their beach house. But we did see lights down the street of where there were two other people who were there, who'd come out to their driveway. And then so we put the radio on, and we had our local ABC commentator, who has a very recognizable voice. It was like, oh gosh, they've made David get out of bed for this. And so he was then telling you what was happening at your main memorial. So the South Australian in Adelaide, there's a war memorial. So he was able to say the Governor General has just arrived and now such and such is here and now the Premier is, laying the wreath, and then sort of said, oh, the bugle's going to start. So then everyone's, oh, okay, good. Quick, Henry, grab your flute. And so away we went. What was beautiful for us is Henry played his flute, and then we heard someone, you know, in a block nearby on their trumpet do it. It was really, really special, really special. Absolutely loved it. And that's the thing, isn't it, that I would never have thought that that would have been a moment, you know, Anzac Day and what happened. Anyway, getting very emotional because it was very, very emotional.
You are. I can see you on video and there's definitely tearing up. Incredible.
I think it's that whole thing of you're all miles apart but you're all still together, and that's when it's all lovely. Nikki, I think we're done. I think we've reached the end. We've managed to get.
It's a long one this week. Let's see how we go with our separate editing techniques.
Oh dear.
All right. Okay, I'll speak to you soon, Kirsty.
Speak soon. Bye.
Bye.